continue with this. So yesterday we dealt with different permutations of how you vote. Do you need unanimity? Do you need majority? Do you need majority but 100% quorum, right? Full representation? Does it depend? In the case of the guilds, and we talked about whether that reflects this is political power, whether this is contract law, something else. We saw that summary really in Rabbi Akiva Eiger. We still have to deal with the topic of Adam Chashuv and what that tells us about this sugya, through some of the permutations that we find here. So the first question I want to deal with is, let's talk about Adam Chashuv for a little bit, okay? So Adam Chashuv, if you just read Shulchan Aruch, what would you guess? What type of person is, whatever exactly Adam Chashuv represents, this limitation of the law, or whatever it is, what type of Adam Chashuv does it sound like? Yeah. If you read Shulchan Aruch, what would you think? Yeah, he says Chacham, right? Now, it could mean a Talmid Chacham, right? A scholar. And you do have some Rishonim who think that's what it is, in which case, this would be an indication of a certain limitation on the power of the laity in favor of rabbinic power. Whether that means that fundamentally it's rabbinic power or it's a rabbinic corrective on lay power, it depends on the sugya. That is one way of reading this sugya. However, it's far from the most likely read in the sugya, and definitely not the only read in the sugya. So before we look at Shulchan Aruch and Osei Kelim, what does the Yad Ramah say on this sugya? First of all, who is the Yad Ramah? His name is the Resh Mem Hei part of it, not the Yad. Hint, yes. That's a play on a phrase, obviously. From where? Where's the what? Shir Ayam. Thank you. What? No, that's the Rama, but the Rama with a hay. Sir Meir Halevi Abu Lafia. Who's getting me the biography here? What? No Wi-Fi. Okay, well, anyways, Rav Meir Halevi Abu Lafia. There you go, So what does he say? He says something very fascinating. This leader needs one, needs two qualifications to count. What is it? He needs to both be a Talmud Chacham and a leader, like a political leader, have power. But if he's just a Talmud Chacham or just a political, a politician, then you don't need his condition, you don't need his power, you don't need his permission. So what does he seem to think is going on here? But what is he saying? He's saying, this is, right, it's not just about Torah. This isn't just telling you that the power here is really about Torah. And it's not only political. It's if someone has two qualifications. He both commands your respect because of Torah. And he has power, so to make a rule when he's present, without asking his permission, in some way undermines the system. Because it undermines both the political system and the religious system. But if he's only a religious leader but not involved in politics, so then you don't need his permission. And if he's only a politician but he doesn't have that intrinsic virtue that comes from being a religious leader, I also don't care what he thinks, right? It's only the combination of him representing political and religious power, that if you don't ask his opinion when he's there, that somehow yes, disrespectful, but I'm looking for a stronger word, but it'll come to me. You understand. Oh, good. So you would say that, right? So let's try to understand why he would say what he's saying, right? So why would you say you need both? Right. So it could be that, look, it's really about the political power, right? Meaning if you have a politician, so he has power, you can't go against him. But, you know, it could be that someone's corrupt, or that his value, or you don't trust his values, or he has no legitimate standing to make the decisions. But if someone is both an acting leader and you trust his qualifications as Talmud Chacham, but according to that formulation, right, the real issue is politics. Right, the real issue here is, if there's a politician, then you have to ask him what is his opinion. You can't just be making laws, right? This is, go back to the Canada case, right? You can't just be making laws when there's a government, right? That undermines the purpose of government. But in Torah, in order to trust that he has the right values and he's making the right calls, so he has to be a Talmud Chacham, right? So according to Yaakov, the main point here is that he's a political leader. The Torah is a qualifier of who do we trust to be that political leader, right? Now, you could have gone the opposite way and said, no, the real issue is Torah, right? Really, this is saying it's disrespectful of Torah to not ask Torah's opinion before you start making rules, but you don't need to ask every single Rosh Hashiva in town before you deal with contract law. But if one of the Rosh Hashiva is also the Rosh HaBezdin and he deals with monetary law, right? So then he's in the know. He's the person who has something to say about politics and about monetary law, right? So you could really go in either direction, right? You could, or a third way is to say, no, it's equal, right? I mean, one way is to say it's really about political power, that when there is a political representative, you can't undermine his authority by not at least checking in. Torah makes sure that he has the right values when he makes those decisions. You could go in the opposite and say it's really about Torah, that it's disrespectful to not ask the representative of Torah his opinion when he's there. If he's not there, no big deal, so you'll just run on contract law. But if he's there, it's just disrespectful to Torah. But not every Talmud Chacham has something to say about economics, right? Or you say, no, it's the unique philosopher king, right, that creates the perfect synergy that you must respect in a system. Right, you can come up any of those models would explain the Yad Rama. But what's clear from the Yad Rama, right, the Yad Rama is not just Torah, right? It's not just Torah, right? It's not that this is an incursion just of Torah into the question. Right? That's not what it is. It's something else. Right? What is exactly? We've had three models. Okay. Look for a second. Okay. You know what? Fine. Okay, let's look at the Pisley Tshuva here. And let's look at some of the cases he brings and try to flesh out some of these possibilities. Now, I will note, you know, Rav Lichtenstein has this piece. I'm probably not going to be able to find it because maybe I can. But let me see if I can find it quickly. Just because I'm recording on the YUTAR app, so I probably can't check something else in on YUTAR at the same time. I'm not really sure. I've never really tried. But let me see if I can do it. Okay, hopefully this is not going to stop my recording. Okay, but Rav Lichtenstein had an article in the Orthodox Forum about rabbinic the balance of rabbinic and lay power in Torah, where he dealt with the question of whether this sugya indicates a certain limitation on lay power. Because look at that. Let's see if I can get it. I also don't have wireless here, and for some reason reception right here is really bad. I don't know why that is. I mean, that's probably a good thing for Shear, all things considered. But let me see if I can even... Oh, look at that. I could get it. Okay, let me read you for a second Rav Lichtenstein wrote here. And he says... Wait 1 second. Okay, so here's how Rav Lichtenstein came in. is that as much as they affect the people within the guild, they also affect the rest of the city, because the guild is integrated into the city. So it could be that the role of the Adam Chashuv is not to act as a control on the power, but to make sure that the decision of a particular group doesn't inadvertently affect the majority, right? So what Rav Lachmanzi notes is just in this quick survey of what's going on with Adam Chashuv, there's a lot of different ways of conceptualizing it. Is it a corrective of Torah power? Is it only using Torah power to prevent the tyranny of the majority? Is it only saying that when there is a Torah-infused government, so then they should have a say, either because it's disrespectful or because you now have the opportunity to turn to the philosopher king to have a better law, so then you should do it? Is, as the Rivash would have it, the only role of the Adam Chashuv is to make sure that the guild laws don't inadvertently affect the community at large? Right? And is it that you only need this Adam Chashuv as a corrective in cases where the punishment that you want to impose is not what the Torah itself would have imposed, and therefore you need some warrant to do that? Okay? I think of Lichtenstein's like 3-4 paragraph summary really paints the picture of all the different directions that can come together in this sugya. Again, we could go and read all of the Rishonim that I just said inside, but I think it's, you know, these models are at least helpful in talking about what's going on here in the broad sense, right? Fleshing it out would take us forever, and you guys would go crazy. I wouldn't. I like doing things in depth forever, but you guys would go crazy, and I made a commitment not to do this year. I keep reminding myself I made a commitment so that I don't break my commitment, but I'm trying here. Okay, does anyone have questions on that, right? Because I think at this point we've at least outlined the main conceptual directions to understand the power as well as this corrective of Adam Chashuv, right? The main directions, right? Again, distinguish between contract law, between guilds and the city, between Talmud Chacham and politician, right? Between cases where there's unanimity and not unanimity. Yes, Yonatan. Yeah, for sure. You could mix and match these. I'm not saying this is exclusive, right? You could mix and match. You could say, yeah, for sure, right? You could say it's to prevent the tyranny of the majority or the tyranny of the minority in the case of the guild, right? Meaning, the case of the guild, you could say, no, it's to prevent the possibility of the tyranny of the minority, right? I mean, that's what it is, right? Think about it, right? What is the role of the SEC or antitrust laws if not to prevent the tyranny of the minority? Right? It's saying we respect contract as long as there isn't a tyranny of the minority. Right? Where you don't create this functional oligarchy of wealthy people who just have power because they can de facto control your life through prices. Right? Because they have full control of the market. Right? That's right. The SEC isn't there is to prevent the tyranny of the minority. Right? I mean, look, you don't need a big chacham to know that that's their point, right? If you just look at political discourse, right? When people say, oh, it's not fair that the billionaires have too much power because they managed to get all the tax break for themselves, right? What they're accusing, right, the system of is exactly that, right? Is that even though they're the minority and they don't technically have power, right? They do have power, right? They have undue power. So like I said, I think this sugya is a excellent, window into the balance of bottom-up power, top-down power, the correctives of Torah power, the role of leaders versus the role of the laity, the difference between small groups, and, you know, full government pictures, right? Again, we're not exhausting this sugya, even though this is day 4, where we're doing this sugya, something like that. Okay, let's say, here's what I want to do. Let's try, whatever we get through today, Ber Heitzev Pesachei Tshuva, I think is all I want to do in the primary sources, okay, because I'm starting to see a little bit of exhaustion in it, and that's fair. I think we've outlined all the directions. Tomorrow, to give you guys a good break, Okay, I'm going to give you a 30-page English article to read, and we're going to have a discussion about the article. But here's what I want you to do, okay? This, because I don't want you just to read it, so here's my goal, okay? There are three, at the beginning of Seder tomorrow when I send it out, he outlines three main directions, okay? I want you guys to divide and each claim a shita to present, okay? You're going to be responsible to present one of the, again, it's all in English, okay? So it's just a question of, I don't know, I'll think about the best way to do it. But I'm going to, tomorrow, we're going to wrap up this sugya by talking about, hopefully in 1 hour, the issue of labor unions and strikes. And again, it's going to be a sophisticated discussion, but not an exhaustive one. But I'm going to give you the English one, and you'll have a break, because I know these sugyas were hard. And then we're going to move on to accountability and transparency, which is one more sugya I want to do in this stop, where it is a little bit more makaros, but not such hard makarot. Which was a shiur that I did with the Right Clapper many, many years ago. It was one of the first shiurim I did the Right Clapper, my first year in Sharon, back in the day, 2008, I think, 2009. Fun times. And I still remember the shiur. I looked back and I found the Makarot sheet. And 90% of what I wanted to put on it was the same as what he put on it back then. I'll tell him we're doing it. He'll be happy. Okay. So let's try to wrap it up a little bit here. So first of all, I'll just note that not everybody agrees with the Rivash's position that Adam Chashuv is only for the guild, obviously. Right? If you look at the Behetiv, he knows that many, many poskim think that whatever control and exception to this power exists in the Adam Chashuv is true for cities also, which is implicit in most of the Rishonim. Right? It's not unanimous. The Rivash doesn't feel that way. But it is... it is true in many of the poskim. Look in the Be'er Heitev about two-thirds down on the first column, and in his parenthetical comment, okay, because I think this is helpful to understand some of the broader issues here, okay? He writes, Hine ra'iti b'sefer b'nei chaye, I saw in the book b'nei chaye, Sheherich ma'od b'inyonei takonot ha'tzibur u'beitin l'migdor milta. I've seen all these different takonot that communities have made. Right? What I want you to understand is that we're talking in theory. But remember, until emancipation, what was the fundamental political organization of the Jewish people? The kehillah. Right? The Jews were granted semi-autonomous political leadership by the non-Jewish government. That's how things worked. So these were real. Like, all these rules were real, and there are lists and lists and lists of takanot that you can find. Right? The communities had this power. So he writes, V'hema milukotim achat la'achat mikama v'kama tshuvot uposkim rishonim v'achronim. There are many, many, many of them that are detailed, early, late, everybody. Right? He said, this was real. Being everything I'm saying may sound foreign. Right? It could be that for us, the only relevance of this is labor unions. But that's because we don't have an autonomous power, even though in Israel it was tried to invoke, right? A lot of the sugyot here were actually invoked as models for the Israeli government. Right? But this was the reality of the semi-autonomous Jewish government in all over the diaspora. It says, even though there are so many, and I can't detail all of them, something, Amarti Lukot Mehem, Shnaim Ushlosha Gargarim, Ulavo Bederecha Mikasrim, right? But I have, what? It's okay. I think I can make it out. He says, but just to give you an idea, I'm going to quote a few of them. And then he quotes some of the rules that we said, right? That even if you think the majority can force the minority, you need full representation, right? That was one law that was passed. And if they've already agreed, so now no one's allowed to protest, right? Once you've made that rule, you have to agree. And he says, if it's to get rid of a danger, so then he thinks the majority can always force the minority, right? No strings attached. If there's a real and present danger, then the majority has to have the power to force the minority. Right? Now, there's a logic to this, and you know this all the time in politics, right? This is like people who say the oil companies have a vested interest in not setting up limitations on how they can pollute the waters. But next thing you know, you have whatever, Flint, Michigan, and polluted waters and whatever, and we don't want that, right? Meaning, if it's sakana, it's not fair to let the minority who have a vested interest in hurting everybody else, right? You can't do that, right? He says to change a minog, one person can protest. He goes through all of these, and again, I don't want to get into all of them, but the point is, what he feels compelled to put in these parenthetical comments, and this is what I want to understand politically and historically, is that this seems foreign to us, but not only is this not something that was, 2,000 years ago and not now, I mean, this was simply the Jewish reality until emancipation. Right? Until emancipation, this was the reality. The Jews had a semi-autonomous government, and they made laws. Right? And therefore, when the poskim are talking about this, was real. And many historians have pointed out that if you want to understand practically what it meant for the laity to have power, you have to look at what they actually had. Meaning, right, this notion of Das Torah, of like the rabbis having all power, right, obviously didn't exist. Because you see that until 200 years ago, the Jews had a semi-autonomous community, and everyone's arguing about how much power to give the laity, what veto does the rabbi have, and is it a rabbi or only a politician? I mean, this is a reality up until right the 19th century, essentially, mid 18th, 19th century, depending on the country. Emancipation reached different places at different times. Right? England, France were different than Germany and Hungary and whatever. They were all different times. So whenever it hit. Okay, and for that reason, I know you guys were a little bit tormented by reading the Pirkei Tshuva. I know it's hard to read. But remember, what is the Pirkei Tshuva? We talked about this. What is the Pirkei Tshuva? Exactly what it sounds like. What is it? It's a collection of tshuvot. It's not a collection of shita. What is it? It's a collection of responsa. What is a responsum? Someone responding to an actual question. And look how long the Pirkei Tshuva is on this one sif. Right? Why is the Pirkei Tshuva so long on this one sif? Yes, because this is how Jewish communities acted, this balance of guild powers and city powers and rabbinic power and political power. This was the Jewish reality. Right? This was a really important question. That's why he's getting so many shilas. Okay? We'll try to get through maybe a few cases in the next, let's say, 5 minutes, and then tomorrow, whatever we don't do, we don't do, and we'll move to one on labor unions, and then we'll move on, and then we'll move on to other sugyas entirely. Okay, so he quotes first the Chassam Sofer, who has a whole case of Reuven, Shimon, and Levi, who were agents in selling wine. Okay, they were the agents on behalf of the government. They got permission from the Tsar. Yes, and they had to follow protocolim. I know people couldn't read that word, but protocol. It means the same thing in whatever language they're speaking as it does in our language. Protocol. They were they were government-approved wine salesmen, and they had to follow government protocol. Right? Protocolin. Protocol. That's all it means. Protocol. Okay? Yes, I know. It was hard to read that, but it's protocol. Pei, resh, aleph, tet, aleph, kuf, aleph, lamed is how in Hungary they spelled protocol. Okay? Sorry. I didn't... And they had certain protocol. What were they? You had to write how many bottles of wine you had, how many you sold, right? There were certain, right, accountability rules that you had to follow by law. That was the rules. Right? Those were the rules. And then the wine sellers would divide the money equally. Right? Basically, there were a few people who together had permission from the government, right? We know this, right? The Jews owned taverns because that was one of the things that the government would give them a license to do. Right, so the Jews here shared the license to sell wine, And the protocol they had to follow was you wrote down how many you sold and you split it evenly because you basically shared the business. Right? That was the protocol. Right? Regardless of who happened to have sold it. Right? That was the rule. And then someone broke the rules and they challenged each other and said, you're going against Dina Malchuta. Right? You're violating the laws that have been set out by the government for our agreement. So the Chassam Sofer says to him, look, Dina de Malchuta isn't just binding in this case because of Dina de Malchuta. Why is it binding? Because these are fair agreements that are made. Right? The Dina Malchuta here reflects a certain agreement that you have amongst businessmen. And even if it weren't Dina Malchuta, I would make you follow these rules. Because that's the agreement you have, and that's the just way of dealing it, and this is just the way, right, you've agreed economically. What? And what's his, one second, and what's his proof that even without Dina de Malchuta, these laws might be binding? Our sugya. He says, look, our sugya says that people in a guild can make laws and they're binding on each other. So who cares if the reason that you made an agreement with each other is because of the law? In the end of the day, law or not law, this was the agreement that all the wine sellers made. So now you have to follow them. Right? And his argument was, you're not only bound because it's the law. You're bound because you entered into this agreement on the backdrop of the law. So that was your implicit guild agreement. That's what you did. And therefore, I will enforce it because internally, this was the agreement you made. We know from our sugya that guilds can make laws on each other. And if the reason the guild made the laws is because that's how the government set up the wine sellers guild, that's how they give out licenses, and this is the protocol you're supposed to follow, so then internal to the halachic system, you are bound. Right, his fundamental insight is simply, don't tell me that the only reason you have guild laws is because the government set it up. The Torah recognizes you make agreements. How you make the agreements, why you make them the way you do, right, that's part of monetary law, even as halacha understands it. So of course I'm going to bind you. And then he says, and Dina de Malchuta is a super case of this. Right? Because you didn't make the law. You entered into a reality where the agreement was made for you. The protocol was set up for you. You understood the parameters. So even if it weren't Dina Malchuta per se, this is a super guild case. And I'll point out, Ramosha has a tshuva like this. The Ramosha says, look, why are you bound by landlord-tenant agreements? Not just because it's contract law. Right? But because, and not because it's Dina Malchuta. But because when it's the law, and you entered into agreement with the backdrop of the law, it is understood to be part of the contract whether you like it or not, right? And there is always this interplay between Dina de Malchuta, the formal rule, and the reality that when there are laws, that shapes the types of agreements you thought you were making in the first place. Okay? And then he notes in this Pitchei Tshuva the machlokes that we already mentioned from that Rav Lichtenstein summarized the Rivash and others as to whether the Talmud Chacham is the Talmud Chacham rule or the Adam Chashev rule is true only in the guild case or even in the city. He thinks the majority think that it's even in the city, but he does note that there's a machloket on these issues, and he quotes this. And again, all the sheets that I quoted from Lichtenstein are here in the Pesach Tshuva. The Rajba, who thinks that it's about Talmud Chacham. Okay, I think that's enough for now. Again, there's a lot more here, but I think this sugya is just a great place to look, to see, again, the way that the Torah conceptualizes power, right, contractual power, political power, bottom-up power, top-down power, correctives on bottom-up power to prevent tyranny of the majority, to prevent tyranny of the minority, in the case of the guilds, influence the rest of the city. The difference between contract that might need unanimity and political power that might need either simple majority or simple majority with total representation, right? The balance between pure rabbinic power and rabbinic power that's melded with political power, right? All these things come into this. So again, you see that it's really the locus classicus of this issue. Okay, we have not exhaustively covered this figure, but I think we've covered it enough that you see the main contours. Again, tomorrow I will just send you Benny Brown's article. Here's what I'm going to do. I know you guys are decently comfortable reading on your phones, so I'm going to send it to you because it's 30 pages. I don't want to waste the yeshiva's paper.